Accession number 10601, Rule 14.
Describing leading these mule trains, were there any particular problems with actually transporting, apart from the ones you've already mentioned about loading the animals, with actually transporting ammunition or food in this way?
Yes, well, one of the problems was aircraft. You've got the Zeros coming over, that's the Japanese fighters, coming low, and of course this in turn used to scare the mules. The mules used to bolt and run off into the jungle. And of course, it took some time again to catch them. And of course, the drabbies, the drivers of these mules, weren't military trained. Sometimes they panicked and ran away and left the mules. And you had to tie mules together from one to the other, like elephants holding the tail of the elephant in front. That was one problem.
How many servicemen actually looked after a mule train?
Well, it varied. There was generally an NCO and about three or four men. They were more or less protection for the mules. The drabbies led them. But it turned out that the men doing protection for the mules become drabbies themselves, because the drabbies used to scarper when they got any enemy action in the vicinity, like low-flying aircraft and what have you.
Did the noise of the mules themselves ever attract enemy fire?
Not in the Arakan, because they never got that close. Later on they did, other actions, but not in the Arakan. Then, of course, you had mules getting lost. The drabby behind didn't concentrate on the drabby in front, and he would turn one track, and the drabby would turn the other drabby would turn along the other track. So you got the party dividing. But on the whole, considering that these men, these drabbies, weren't army trained, they did a good job.
Can you remember any particular incidents yourself when you were in charge of a mule train?
No, just when the aircraft came over, or shelling took place. They used to bolt, we had to round them up. That was the only time. And of course, as I mentioned before, when they were abducted.
We got onto this because we were talking about food. Did you have your own cooking facilities up in the front line? Did you have a primer stove or something like that which to cook things with?
Some sections did have a primer stove which they could make a cup of tea, but it wasn't the general thing. The general thing was to get your tea brought up in canisters from the echelon. If your section had a primer stove, then you were very lucky. Some sections did, but we, Britannic Quarters, never had a primer stove.
Okay, and what about special rations? You mentioned rum in connection with the water carrier filled with rum. How often did you get that ration?
Well, not very often in action. In the Arakan, we only got it twice that I remember. Twice in the Arakan.
What did it consist of?
Because the rum ration, you see, was classified as not necessary. It wasn't like the Navy, where they get a special ammunition, get a truck of rum. And with the transport being what it wasn't essential. But, of course, on occasion, we did get it twice.
How much of a ration?
Well, I don't exactly know what the quota was. What used to happen was it come up in barrels. And each company would probably get a barrel. And when you went to get your stew with your mess tin, and your sweet, your rice pudding, you know, after you'd finished your dinner, you'd go back and get your tea, and they'd put the rum in the tea, a measure of rum. There's no strict measure, just like a spoon or something, a ladle, just dipped it in for your tea. And the reason why you put in your tea was you might give your rum to somebody else, and somebody else might give his rum to him, and that chap would end up with quite a lot of rum, raw. And we didn't want that. And that's why it was put in your tea, so you couldn't give it away. So whether they liked it or not, you had to drink it. Of course, it wasn't half so bad. Those who didn't like rum, drinking the rum out of tea, with tea as well as drinking rum raw, you see. That's another point. Lots of people could drink rum that way, where they couldn't drink it raw. But the main theme was to stop people from giving the rum to somebody else, and not somebody else getting far too much rum and going over the top.
Mm-hmm. And cigarettes, were they in regular
supply? Yes, the cigarettes is quite good. I wish to get tins of 50, Capstan. They were full of saltpeter, mind you, the cigarettes. When you lit them, they burned down very quick. You could hear the saltpeter cracking in them. But we're never short of cigarettes, and even tobacco. I smoked a pipe. I always had a good supply of tobacco. Of course, the padre just looked after me for that, because what used to happen, families would send tobacco out to the offices, mostly the families. Well, if those officers were in hospital or being killed, the padre got those parcels, you see. Anybody being killed, he got the parcels and the mail, and he examined it and read it and sorted the parcels out. And of course, padre and I was on the best of terms. He'd always come to me with a tin of tobacco, four square, Ogden's cut, clear cut, things like that, and always had a good supply of tobacco. Even pipes. They sent pipes out, and the parry cut me say, how are you fixed for pipes? And get a new pipe off them. I think that was about the best thing we ever got, tobacco and cigarettes.
Were there any other special rations that you can recall having?
Occasionally, we'd get fresh greens flown in from Calcutta and brought up. I'm saying fresh greens, they were maybe 3 or 4 days old, but fresh to us, like Brussels sprouts, cabbage, which was a luxury. Potatoes was plentiful. And nearby there was a tomato plantation. We got tomatoes. Of course, out there the tomatoes don't grow like they grow in this country. They grow like strawberries on the ground. And there was a big field not very far away, and we got a good supply of tomatoes.
Were you able to catch any wildlife at all to supplement rations?
No, do that? We never bothered with wildlife. As a matter of fact, there wasn't a great lot of wildlife apart from snakes, because most of the wildlife left the area when the firing took place. They'd been disturbed and looked for better ground, I suppose. And we never got any trouble with any wildlife.
You've mentioned the fact that water was in the Arakan, water was in reasonably plentiful supply, and you could bath quite regularly, even when you were in the front lines. Mm-hmm. Were what sanitary arrangements existed?
None, really. It was just a matter of a chap, when he felt inclined, he would go 2 or 3 yards further back in his trench, dig a little hole with his trenching tool, do his business there and cover it up, if he was lucky. But it was a risk, very risk. I've seen some men that have had to do it in the trench they stood in, on things quieting down, then clean it up. That was a very bad thing, that sanitation. You just couldn't overcome the situation. There was no answer to it. None at all.
Is this because you were so much pinned down by the
Japanese? Yeah, you're pinned down, you see. Some places you just put your head above the trench. If you did, you got these snipers, because you never knew where they were going to be.
And what about pests? You mentioned scorpions and you mentioned snakes. Were there any particular pests at Arakan that were...
There were scorpions and snakes, but they never gave us any bother. Again, a snake, we discovered, a snake won't bother you if you give it a fair chance. The only time a snake will strike is if it's when it's hibernating or when it's breeding. every possible chance of get a snake will run or crawl or whatever it does from any sound effects, marching, gunfire, what have you. And if you stand on the snake, you're damned unlucky. I never knew anybody who ever did. But that's the only possibility that ever arose. We were told that snakes wouldn't attack only if they were disturbed in hibernation or if they were breeding, hatching eggs, something like that. And we never experienced that.
The Araucana, of course, it was a battlefield that had been going for some time before the DLI actually arrived. Were there any dead bodies still lying around?
No, well, there was very little action in the Araucan before we arrived. You must bear in mind the Araucan had two phases. Mm-hmm. The phase we were in, then when we evacuated and went to Kohima, there was a seaborne force went in the Araucan and carried up operation we were going to carry out. But previous to us going in, there was very little evidence of any action. I think the Chindits had been in doing a patrol at some time or other, because there was one or two crosses, but there was no like debris or shell holes or demolition like you'd normally get. Just the odd grave here and there.
One last thing about the Araucan. I'd just like you to take me through a typical daily routine that you had whilst you were in the front line.
Well, in the whole, for the majority, the forward troops, the day was spent in the slit trench. You would find some writing letters, reading letters for the 10th, maybe 12th time. Some would be sleeping, while others was on stag, as we called it. To each slit trench, you always got a man on stag, watching, waiting, listening, where his colleagues, as I say, wrote letters. Very few used to read. Most of them used to sleep, doze off. And then you had maybe fatigue duties, carrying ammunition up, carrying water supply up. Very few fatigues, though.
What time would the day start? When was stand two?
Well, stand two would be just at dusk, about 7:30. Now, on stand two, it was 100% turnout. Colonel and everybody stood too, because these are reckoned to be the most crucial moments. If attack's going to come in, it'll come in then. And it was very nerve-wracking. Not a word was spoken. Watches were synchronised. And you just waited. Of course, in most cases, nothing happened. Then they should come out to 25% stand two after about an hour, called stand down. Well, stand down was 25%. And that 25% changed hands during the course of the night. You get maybe 2 hours off or 4 hours off and two on, depend upon the strength of the section. And this went on during the night. Hence the reason the men slept a lot through the day. So your day was really sleeping and writing letters. Odd fatigues, maybe reinforcing the positions, changing your camouflage, things like that. Just general duties as a soldier does in action.
That stands.
Of course, you might have an attack come in during the night, where again a 100% turnout. Well, that upset the apple cart. It means everybody was awake, and the following day was spent collecting casualties. And again, reinforcing positions, because during the attack, you've maybe vacated your position and found yourself in an advanced position, which again meant you had to dig in and consolidate. Or vice versa, you may have gotten braid back a few yards, 10 or 20 yards. And again, you had to dig in and reinforce your positions. But if you had no attack during the night, next day was spent sleeping and writing letters and fatigues in general.
Was there any attempt to strengthen the positions at night time?
Strengthen them?
Yes.
At night time? No, not at night time. There's a two or three occasions when you had attacks coming in during the night. You have to stand down, because the Jap got wise to this. He knew that he had 100% front to contend with, but he knew that after a certain period of time, he only had a 25%, and that's the tactics that come in by midnight. You see? And it'd go on until daylight. Well, daylight then should be about 4 o'clock. So you had like 4 hours of attack coming at you. And of course, in that situation, you got casualties that'd be dealt with next day. Some had to be buried. Some carried back to the regimental aid post. Some used to just try and hang on the best they could.
Did you have any sentry duties to do yourself?
Not as such, but I did my share to lessen the burden on the others. And even the CO and the adjutant, signal officer, intelligence officer, they all took the turns. But of course, they took the turns with the officer's staff. The second command, the adjutant would take place of the colonel, then the signal officer would take place of the adjutant, and so forth, so that you had a senior officer on stand two all through the night. You couldn't expect the colonel to be on duty all through the night, but you did have a senior officer.
Okay. One last question is, what effects do you think that this daily routine had on the men?
Monotonous. Boring. I remember when we came out of the Arakan, the first night and marched back, the falling out left, right and centre. And this is only due to being cramped in dugouts. That's the worst time I've ever experienced of men falling out on the march, coming back the first night. And that's all it was due to. Men being cramped for days on end in slit trenches, dugouts. They hadn't been active, you see. And of course, they'd been concentrating all the time. They were weary and tired with concentration. And of course, when you're in a slit trench forward, you don't get the vitamins you normally would get. The feeding habits changed.
So you think they were less fit when they came out?
Oh, yes. When you got a rest period for 2 days, it was a godsend. After 2 days, you're a new man. And surprisingly, these fellas were only young, you know, in the early 20s and teens, and surprising how quickly they could recuperate. Surprising. You couldn't do it at the old age, but they could do it. We could do it then.
You had rest periods when you were at the Arakan?
Yes, we had rest periods. We came back to the Chong. The battalion came back to the Chong. And,
how far was that behind the actual frontline position?
Oh, about 300 yards. And the Royal Welsh, or the Royal Berks, would take over from us. And that gives a chance to wash our underclothes in the stream and get some hot bully beef stew curry into us, clean our weapons up. And it was a change of duties. Again, you see, it vitalised the whole of the body, a change of duties. Even though you're still under enemy fire, artillery fire, that was nothing compared to being under small arms fire and having to sit and watch and wait. You could relax and get out writing a decent letter. And the main thing was getting the wash and your underclothes washed. That refreshed you up. And even in some cases, men got their hair cut in such a fashion, like, but they got it cut. And you got your beard right down, shaved. I mean, 3 or 4 days' growth wasn't very comfortable.
You were in the frontline positions for a period of 3 or 4 days, and then you...
Well, sometimes more than that. Sometimes in there for weeks. But in the Arakan, we're only in about 7 or 8 days at a time, in the Arakan, because only a small front. You see, you could afford to change your troops more regular.
What rest duties did you have?
Rest duties? Well, nothing specifically. I just took me rest when I could during the daytime. If I felt like a lie down, I wasn't nothing to do, I went to sleep. Because you could go to sleep just like that. I just used to sit in a hole and dug out and just not have to sleep. Everybody knew where I was. Nothing special to do. The rations was up and everything was in order as far as we were concerned.
So you didn't? You had no particular duties?
No particular duties.
And was there any attempt to sort of spruce the men up at all in this you know, this...
Well, they did get their new battle dress when they came back for a rest. The quartermaster store truck would come up, or the mule column would come up with socks and new battle dress rather than wash them, you know, because they were very, you could very well wash a battle dress that hadn't scalded hot water because they were full of grease, body grease. And rather than wash them, it was easy to get a new battle dress, and that was stimulating. New pair of socks, new pair of boots.
And this happened every time you went to rest?
Yes, every time you went to rest, you got a, it was available, in most cases it was available. The supplies was always there, thanks to the RAF. But the Arakan battle on the whole, as I said before, was our best train we ever did. And considering that the casualties weren't very heavy, we got it at a very small price. Men were killed, but not a great lot, as many as was killed later on.
Okay, can we return now to Aminaga, and can you take the story up? Well, you've just come back having been ill.
Mm-hmm.
What was going on in Aminaga when you arrived back?
Well, they were reinforcing, really, because we'd lost casualties, and not only that, a lot of men had went down with malaria, and the battalion was just reinforcing and taking things easy. There was no training, no route marches, and the chaps was just quite happy lying on the beds, reading. Relaxation more than anything else. Then they started on PT, early morning PT, 5 o'clock before breakfast, on the what we call the Maya Dam. You would call it the Barrack Square, but it wasn't the Barrack Square as we know it. And mass PT companies. And then they did a bit of cross country running. They gradually built up the stamina again.
Did you have to go on these exercises as well?
No, not really, because my constitution wasn't as low as theirs in the first place. And apart from that, I had my normal duties to carry out, which kept me occupied. You know, my morale wasn't shattered to the extent that the men were. And it just a matter of me following on where I'd left off prior going to the Arakan.
Was there any particularly special training taking place?
Not for a while. Later on, they did marching in the afternoons, which was unusual. Midday marches, we called them. Mad dogs and English went out in the midday sun. And the battalion, by companies, would go on a 2-hour route march. That's about as much as they could stand under the heat. And I never went on any of these marches. But I've heard the lads say they're marching through villages and all the inhabitants, even the dogs, was lying asleep under the trees and they were marching past. And well, it's true saying, mad dogs in English out in the mad day sun. The lads just say that even the natives was lying flat out. The dogs lying asleep, they hadn't listened to bark. But I suppose that was from experience we got marching into the Arakan. You know, the SEAL must have thought, well, this will not happen again. You know, because it was a gruesome march.
Did you receive any leave at this point?
Yes. I'd forgotten all about that. I never took any leave, but there's some chaps got 2 and 3 leave periods. And they went down to a place called Beach Candy, Bombay, where there's like a swimming pool and palm trees. Some went to Calcutta. There was leave camps established at various places where there's full entertainment going on, dances, where the half chats, the local girls would come in and dance. But I never took any leave.
Why not?
I was like McLean. I was too dedicated. I wasn't a sort of an entertainment seeker. I was just quite prepared to go my normal duties. I wasn't one for dancing and boozing. I didn't drink a great deal. And my duties weren't strenuous duties. They weren't boring duties. I didn't find any sense in it, really, me going to leave. But mind you, I agree with the men going and leave. And when they came back, they were all the better for it. They're putting weight on and they're starry-eyed, you know, and ready to go again. But there was 2 or 3 occasions where they got 2 or 3 periods where the battalion got leave. So many times, you know. Of course, you could let as many men as you want go on leave at that stage, Amanaga, because you're well behind the fighting and everything. And you got this, like, bulk leave. But they all enjoyed it.
Okay.
Of course, this was leading up to when we're going to go further afield into Burma.
Well, perhaps you'd like to take the story on from there, into that then.
Into our next operation. Mm-hmm. I suppose everybody was aware of the fact that we hadn't come to the end of the road. The war was still going on, that would still be needed. And the most likely place we'd be needed would be in Burma itself.
Was this commonly discussed at the time?
It was commonly known. Because at that particular time, there's very few troops in Burma. And at Kahim itself, the main town, there's only one battalion in Burma, and they were on peacetime bases. Garrison troops, for a start. So you had very few troops in Burma. And naturally, we knew that that's where we'd be going to. And with the experience behind us, we had, and us haven't had many casualties, and haven't had this leave, so the lads were raring to go. But we discovered that it wasn't as easy as the Arakan. There was different kettle of fish going into Burma than it was going to the Arakan.
When did you actually set out for Burma?
Well, I can't exactly remember the date when we left Amanaga, but we left by train. I know it was quite a tough journey.
Can you describe the journey?
We were in carriages, some similar to cattle trucks. They didn't have windows in, they had bars up. The toilets was blocked up. And if I'm not mistaken, it took us somewhere in the region of 3 weeks. Now then, we were getting shunted into sidings and held up. And the excuse was they had to make way for the industrial trains coming through. But that wasn't so. We're being held up. It was fifth column. You've got lots of station masters who were in the Congress Party, Gandhi's party, who didn't want us, wanted home rule. And we discovered lately that these being pushed in the sidings for a couple of days, it wasn't because of a traffic jam, it was just fifth column sabotage.
Was this being talked about at the time?
No, we did not actually. We didn't do that at the time. So you're pushing the sidings for a couple of days, and you went maybe for 3 days again, and these trains, which was non-ventilated, bad toilet arrangements, and we even had to stop on occasions and collect wood for the engine. You run short of coal. Again, sabotage. And the whole battalion had to detrain and scavenger for wood and then take it up to the train and keep the engine going. And then...
Can you tell me a little bit about, since you're on the train for such a long time, what you've mentioned the toilet facilities, what were the actual carriages like and how were the troops organised in them?
Well, they were just bundling by platoons. I see, maybe two platoons to a carriage. The carriage had hard seats, wooden seats, along the side, bench. And you slept on your seat or on the floor. That racks for your kit, which often fell off and hit you on the head while you were asleep. They were rackety. Springs had gone on them. You would think they had square wheels. And the track was run down for the belly need repair. You could feel every joint you went over. And you were stiff and sore next morning when you got up. But occasionally the train would stop early on the morning, the whole of the town would get up and do PT in a suitable place where there was open space. We'd get up and do PT.
But most of the time you spent on the train?
Oh, yes, all the time spent the day except for your PT.
And what about food? What did you have?
Well, again, we had a ration truck at the back, and the food was frequent and plentiful. What we used to do is take our containers, Dixies, up to the engine and make our tea and stew from the engine. You know, just put the corned beef and the veg into the Dixie. And take it off the engine, he would turn his scalded water on, and that's how we got our meals. from the engine. Mm-hmm. And this carried on for about, I think, 3 weeks until we arrived at the railhead. Now, the railhead was Dimapur. That's as far as we could go. And when we detrained, we had to take up defensive positions in the vicinity of the railhead because it was reported that Japanese patrols had broken through into Dimapur.
Can you remember roughly what time of
about 8 o'clock at night.
Not time of day so much as the time of year, what year we're in now.
We're in 44.
Is it, this must be the beginning of 44.
Aye. Well, March, April. It'd be March 44 when we arrived at Dimapur because I spent my birthday, April, at Kohima. I was 24 years of age. So when we arrived at Dimapur, there was reports that Japanese patrols broke through and threatened